Välkommen till Sveriges första podcast om human design på svenska med Emelie Eriksson och Marlie Montan.
Hello! We're back!
Yay!
Yay! And we are very excited to have a guest with us today. And Emelie has known John for a while and she's gonna introduce him a little bit. So here you go, Emelie.
So today we're shooting in English. I asked John, our guest today, if he wanted to join us in our podcast. And you asked me, John, but how are we going to do that? Because you do it in Swedish. And I said, well, you just have to learn Swedish really quick then.
Yeah, crash course.
So, John, very welcome here. You have been my mentor for the last months, actually, in studying human design. And we wanted to invite you today to this podcast to talk a bit about being a male projector. Yeah. And we would like to hear you say, give us a little bit of an introduction of yourself first. How did you find the human design and how has your deconditioning process been?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. And it's been an interesting road working with human design. I think I'm around 7.5 years or going on 8 years into it. And I came into it from astrology. I had a background in astrology. I'd been studying that for really almost 2 decades when the human design showed up. And so I was already kind of in that world or working with those type of systems. And a friend of mine, a fellow astrologer, kind of threw it in my lap, another projector, and said, hey, you should look at this, and kind of dropped it on me and sent me my chart and said, we're both projectors. This is kind of interesting. Do you know anything about it? And I remember my first impression was, this can't work. This is a crazy system. I don't see who put this together. This is not going to work. And then I started reading up on it and investigating it and looking into human design. And one of the first things that shows up is, you know, this type thing, this auric type of being a projector. And once that started to land and I started getting a sense of what that was actually saying, it kind of reframed most of my life. It reframed my childhood, a lot of the experiences I had had. I grew up in a family of 3 generators. I had no idea what was going on energetically. I just knew that I was not like them, and something was different, and something was off. I was also, you know, I've got only individual definition. I don't really fit that well into like tribal and penta constructs. And so human design started kind of giving me a different way of looking at that, which made sense. It's kind of, it explained things. It was kind of like a missing puzzle piece from everything I had been looking at and trying to make sense of, even in astrology. So that kind of grabbed me, just this idea of, you know, what it meant to be a projector. And then I just dove in. I just, if something gets me like that, then I tend to go for it and just immerse myself in it for a while. And so I got a foundation reading, started taking classes. I didn't really know where it was going, but it was just kind of one thing led to the next. And then that, you know, that was kind of my process early on with human design, but it was coming at a time in my life where I guess that was around 2015. And so I was in the middle of like all of those kind of midlife changes and stuff that goes on in your 40s. I was coming out of a Uranus opposition. I had been living as a manifesting generator or a conditioned not self manifesting generator for most of my life. And it hit a major period of burnout. I left 2 jobs. I was like, if I keep working at these jobs, I'm going to end up in the hospital. This is just not sustainable. And so it started helping me make sense of, you know, of what was going on. And one of the things that I think it really highlighted was that there wasn't something wrong with me. And because I had thought I had some sort of weird illness or condition, or why am I so tired? Why can't I keep up? Why am I exhausted all the time? I had been seeing doctors and specialists before human design showed up and trying to, you know, basically look under every stone and see what I could find. And human design comes along and says, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just trying to live in a way that you're not designed for. And so that brought up all sorts of stuff that really kind of kicked off a big deconditioning process as I looked back and, you know, started piecing things together.
Mm. Can you recognize this, Marley, feeling like...
Yeah, I'm like, like nodding over here to everything that you're saying, because I can really relate to that. I grew up in a family with only generator and manifesting generator people as well, and I'm the only projector. But I actually, when I found human design, I did not think that I was a projector. I was sure that I was a manifesting generator, because that's what I've been like living my whole life. And when I started to like read up on the projector, I was like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. But I hadn't like really felt that I was even tired, because I didn't know anything else. I just kept going and going and going. And then I'm like, oh my God, is this the way I'm supposed to live? And when I started to just kind of reconnect again, then the like the tiredness and the exhaustion and everything just came upon me. But I can really relate to your story and what you're telling. But I'm just curious, was there something at like the start of your journey that you couldn't relate to, like about being a projector? Or was everything just, oh my God, this is just so amazing being seen in this way?
It really landed in a way that kind of felt like a confirmation or kind of a validation of a lot of what I had kind of experienced and tried to work out, you know, before human design showed up. I'm trying to think if there's anything that didn't really sit well. You know, being an ego being, you know, I have the 2551, a defined will center, and yeah. It's been an interesting process for me to kind of come to terms with what I guess you could say is kind of the no choice aspect of everything. That's something I really kind of opposed early on, you know, being, you know, willful. It's like, don't tell me what to do or what I can and can't do. I'll be the judge, or I'll determine that. And so that was something that showed up in human design. It's like, yeah, I'm not so sure about this. You know, this no choice thing, and we'll see. And then there, you hear about like the 7 years of kind of deconditioning to really get into it. And I was like, yeah, we'll see about that too. I've done a lot of work. I've, you know, studied a lot of things. I've been a part of a lot of, you know, whatever spiritual kind of work or traditions. And so that was something I struggled with. And then over the last, you know, 7 or so years, my position's dramatically changed on that. So that's been interesting. But yeah.
Do you have any like concrete examples of how you changed your approach to life after learning about your aura and your strategy?
Yeah. Well, some of it kind of framed what I had already seen in my experience, where I could look back and say, look back on like events and things that had happened and see, did I initiate that, or was I invited in? Did that come from the outside? Did that come through someone else? And I could see that in a lot of cases, the best things that, you know, in terms of what worked out, the best opportunities came in through invitations or some form of recognition from the outside. Whether it was getting a new job or kind of landing somewhere else, or, you know, making connections through, you know, I'm also a 2-4, so that's part of it. But it just made sense. And I was like, okay, maybe that's what all that stuff was. That's why it worked out that way. And it allowed me to kind of accept that, or to kind of ease into that in a way, just to experiment with it more and to kind of go further down that road. But that's been kind of a slow process. I'm finding, you know, actually that I'm still, as of even, you know, last year, I'm still learning what an invitation is. It's like you hear that and you're like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I have a point of reference for that. But I really think it's an individual process of, you know, coming to terms with what strategy and authority is in your life as an individual. Mm-hmm. And I'm still working that out, you know, that and my authority, my will-based authority, those have it's been kind of a gradual unfolding, I guess, in terms of, you know, identifying when that's actually happening in my life. Because sometimes invitations come in, or what looks like an invitation, and later I realized that really wasn't an invitation. That was something that I wanted, or I was hoping would work out a certain way, or, you know. And projectors are often, they feel like, you know, we're sitting on the sidelines and just kind of waiting for someone to recognize us, notice us. And then something comes along and we jump on it. It's like, oh, this must be an invitation. But no, it's actually just an ask. It's just a request. It's just something that someone's kind of throwing at you versus a real invitation. So that's been part of it. But yeah, once I kind of got into the experiment of it, it changed everything. It just, like, things start kind of blowing up, basically. If you follow your strategy and authority, it's going to bring up stuff. It's going to bring up issues with yourself, issues with others, issues with the world. And then it's kind of a fun mind game to work all that out.
I'm really curious about your inner authority, because it's quite rare. You have what is called an ego projected authority. Mm-hmm. So you only have the 2551 channel, and I have that one as well in my chart. But how does it work when it's your inner authority?
Yeah, I mean, if you just kind of look at my definition on the surface and the body graph, you've got the will center, the heart, or the ego center colored in red, and then you've got the yellow G center of self, identity, love, direction. And that's kind of defines me. That's what I am. I'm kind of a self-willed being. And you could keynote it lots of different ways, but that is basically kind of like my railing. You know, this is the thing that I can hold on to. It's my consistent point of reference, is my will and my identity. And that was also a process of kind of coming to learn, or to see, like, what's actually happening there. When I first got into human design and you start learning about being an ego projector, you know, you hear things like, well, it's about what you have the will for, or what you really want. And those things are true, I think, but I don't know that that applies all of the time in daily life. You know, it's like the way I've kind of come to understand, and my authority in that process is, or that kind of movement is, there are certain things that feel like I can't not do them. Like, I have to do this. It's a part of who I am. And so I actually kind of see this strong connection between the will and the G as really describing how that authority works. It's not just the will, it's also the G center. So it's kind of this willful movement in a direction of my true self, or highest self, or who I really am. And what I've found is, most of the time, it's kind of the ego wants to rest. It's kind of, it doesn't want to work daily like the sacral center. It doesn't have the capacity to do that. And so there are only certain times where that will really kicks in strong, and it's almost a feeling. And this goes kind of back to the no choice thing, is I don't feel like I actually have a choice about what I have to do and want to do. You know, it's like my will, it's going to move and do and kind of orient the way it does. And I can either go along with that, or I can kick and scream along the way and, you know, protest. It's usually the mind doing that. And so the big discovery for me with my authority was that there's no choice in it, which is really kind of interesting, because, you know, we talk about authority as, this is how we make decisions, or some people will describe it that way. I don't really direct or choose my authority. My authority kind of moves on its own or not. The will, that when it kicks in, it has this feeling of kind of taking me on a ride. Like, I'm going to go along with this and go along with this movement towards whatever it is that I'm, you know, the G center is often about, like, love and what you're attracted to. And there's a pull, like almost like a magnetic kind of pull in all of that. And it feels like no choice. It just feels like, okay, I can't not do this. And that has been kind of one of the main consistent kind of flavors or ways that my will tends to express in terms of big decisions, in terms of, like, big changes. On a daily basis, you know, there are moments of will, there are moments of kind of things where I'll kind of run into myself, which is kind of interesting. If you think about definition is something we have to deal with. Other people have to deal with it. We have to deal with our own definition, you know, and it's kind of non-negotiable. And so I think that tells us something about the authority in the same way, like a sacral authority is either going to respond or not, regardless of what we think about it, right? You have the energy or you don't. It's, you can't make yourself, you can drag yourself through something with, you know, with not a lot of energy behind it, but you're kind of going against yourself, or you just go with where your energy naturally wants to move. And it's, I think it's kind of like that as well with the ego or the heart center, because it's a motor and it's not an awareness center. It's just like, you're going with that movement of energy or you're not.
Mm. But I can also feel, I mean, I don't have the same inner authority as you have, but I do have the same channel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this, the no choice, it's also kind of a feeling of doing my duty. So for me, it sometimes feels, you know, like it comes from the heart, that it's something deeper than me that is guiding me to what is my purpose or my duty in life. And it's not like a duty that is horrible or full of moral or something like that, but it's more like a joyful duty, actually.
That's interesting. I'm sitting here with my open heart center, no gates, and completely open, and I'm like, yeah. But I just think it's interesting to hear like both of your stories, because I think that the main issue that a lot of people go through is that we don't listen at all to what comes naturally. We kind of ignore our own like basic human instincts and instead just follow whatever is like surrounding us at the moment, or what's trendy, or what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of miss all of these signals that you guys are talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's kind of what human design is offering us. It's offering us basically a map, a framework that gives us some signposts, some points of reference. And then it's really up to us as part of the experiment to work that out in the context of our life and yeah, what's coming up for us. And I think you're right in that it's a process of kind of tuning into oneself in a certain way, or listening, whatever your design kind of brings. But if we're being kind of whipped around by the outside world and, you know, whatever shiny objects are passing by, then we're probably not going to go too deep into that. But I think that's really what it's about.
Yeah. And then we have the opposite, which is doing things because you think you have to, living like this.
Yes.
Gray life.
Well, that's a really interesting point. That's related to my experience of my authority. Is I started looking at the opposite of, you know, when you have to, or you can't not, or you're willed to do it. I saw in my life, it's kind of going back to some of what we were talking about earlier, where I was allowing myself to get pulled into all sorts of things. And I think some of this is the 2-4 dynamic. It was a lot of social stuff that I actually didn't want to do. I didn't have the will for. And then I was finding myself in situations where I didn't really want to be, and like, how did I get here? And then I'd have to take a couple steps back, like retrace my steps and be like, why am I doing this again? Well, how did I end up here? And I don't want to do it. And so what I saw was that it was almost a kind of self-harm to keep allowing myself to be put in positions, or to say yes, or to do things that I really didn't want to do. It's mm-hmm. like the inverse of what you really want to do. And so that was part of the kind of the process of coming more into alignment, is let me really kind of, if it's a big deal, if it's going to take a lot of energy, or if it's a commitment that, you know, I need to honor. And that's the other thing of having an ego, is be careful what you commit to, because you got to deliver on a certain level. But you know, on those type of situations, you know, I need to be really clear that I had the will for it. And that was a process of tuning into myself to really get clear on, you know, what was going on, and then falling into alignment with it. And then the other side was to stop doing stuff that I didn't want to do, and to kind of own that on a certain level, which then brought up these other themes, like, you know, avoiding truth and confrontation, you know, undefined solar plexus. Yep. And so once you kind of go down that road, it starts kicking off all sorts of stuff. It's going to, you know, other people may not like, you know, what you want to do or where you're going or what's important to you. So.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important aspect of this human design journey is to actually take a good look at yourself and noticing why are you saying yes to certain things and why are you saying no to certain things. And that brings the next question for you, John, because you have a lot of open centers or undefined centers in your chart. And I think most of us have recognized that these undefined centers can be one of the biggest challenges when we are trying to live as ourselves, because they try to tell us to do stuff that maybe aren't our path.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have been looking at your chart, have you seen, is it any of these undefined centers in your chart that has been a bigger challenge for you than the others?
The solar plexus is pretty big. Yeah. And if you look at it, and there's kind of a hierarchy of, you know, open center, not self, pressure, themes, however you want to look at that. And so for me, it really would be, you know, after the ego, it's the solar plexus. So that was a pretty big thing. I realized that most of my life had been spent in avoiding a certain type of emotional confrontation or intensity feeling. And then I realized that, you know, in doing that, I'm kind of cutting myself off from the richness of human experience. You know, it's to kind of like to constantly avoid, and, you know, we, you know, projectors can be pretty, how to say it, you know, we have to rely on a certain type of intelligence, you know, in lieu of the lack of energy that a lot of us experience. And so we can kind of work things, and, you know, projectors can be kind of crafty or manipulative and all that stuff. And I'd kind of look back and seen like how I had kind of wormed my way around all these different situations. And a lot of it was fueled by avoidance. And so then that's something that kind of came up as part of the process. The spleen, I had looked back and seen how long I stayed in positions or in jobs or in situations, relationships from some sort of security narrative that actually didn't really hold up or really wasn't mine. And then the cost of that, you know, like staying in a job for way too long, even though, you know, it was making me sick and going to land me in the hospital, at least I had, ironically, you know, insurance and a salary, but it was making me sick the whole time. And so it wasn't working for me. And so, yeah, the spleen was a big one. The ajna, these awareness centers, I look back and I could see how much I tried to be certain, you know, and I was trying to prove to myself that I knew what I was talking about, or I could, you know, appear certain to other people. And, you know, I've got one gate in my ajna. It's really not about that. And so with seven undefined centers, it's a lot of deconditioning work. It's a lot that's going to come up. And I can relate to all of them in a way.
Mm. Both me and Marlee are completely open in our solar plexuses. So we feel you on that one.
Yeah, we can totally relate. Definitely.
But I'm really curious about the spleen, because both you and me, Marlee, we are defined in our spleen centers. Yeah. And I think most people in my life are defined as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about this theme of fear. Do you find yourself amplifying other people's fear in your undefined spleen? Or does it have to do more with health and security and safety?
Yeah, the fear thing is interesting. When I look back, I think I had a lot of fear, like early on growing up. And yet, at the same time, I didn't really, some people may have considered me kind of fearless in a way, or kind of, you know, that part of that's coming from the 2551, which is kind of a little bit crazy in a way. Hopefully in a good way most of the time. But you put that together, being a projector, running around, amplifying all the energy around you with all that, you know, openness. And I took a lot of risk. I guess that's one way to say it. I took a lot of risk. I felt like I got lucky, like, you know, that I'm actually sitting here talking to both of you today. You know, it's like, and I feel like it was a learning process, you know, of kind of when the way I'm looking at undefined centers more and more is that we don't come in with that hardwired into our being. It's not like we have that kind of innate sense of like, okay, this is safe, this is healthy, this is not. It's something that has to be learned over time. And over time, if you kind of stop trying if the mind will kind of get out of the way in that area and release its grip on that aspect of life, I feel like the undefined centers kind of open up a type of freedom or something. It's not fixed. It's not limited in the same way that, you know, definition is. And so you can bring awareness to that area and start seeing something and learning something. And maybe at some point, you know, there's some wisdom coming from the experience. And that's kind of what I've seen over the course of my life is I'm a lot less impulsive and kind of throwing caution to the wind when it comes to, you know, themes of security and, you know, risk and fear. But at the same time, I still don't really have a fixed way of dealing with it. It's just, it depends. It depends on what's going on, the conditions. And then in those situations, that's when I'll usually take it back to my definition, to my ego, my G, and say like, hey, am I really up for this? You know, as I can, when I tune in and turn, you know, inside and check in with myself, is this something that I can handle? Is this something that I'm up for? Can I pull this off? And if the answer is no, then there you go. Then I don't do it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. I like that. But would you say that that is a huge difference from before human design, that you now go back inside and check with yourself before you like approach things in life?
Yeah. When it counts, I hope that I do. You know, that's what I'm working on, is to really kind of check in with myself on when the bigger things come up, or when I can just feel like, okay, there's something here, just slow down and pause, or which is, you know, the invitation really helps. You know, I think the invitation in a way sets up a situation or a space where you can, you know, listen to your authority or tune into your authority. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I feel like, you know, it's been, yeah, it's just been a process.
Yeah. Is the waiting for the invitation part a huge difference from how you were living before?
Yeah, I feel like I was just kind of getting whipped around by the energy and not knowing what's going on. I mean, you look at my chart and it's got this little island of definition and a mm-hmm. big sea of openness. And that's pretty descriptive of how it kind of feels sometimes. It's like I actually had an early human design teacher once. I don't know if I mentioned it before, Emily, but I had someone tell me when I first got into human design, I was doing some sessions with different people. And he said, you know, you're just a dumb ego flying through space. And I was like, wow, that's quite a thing to say to somebody, you know, I love your bedside manner there, but it was true on a certain level. You know, it's just, it's not an awareness center. And if you're not like working with that or attuned to that, listening to that or in touch with that, that's what it's going to look like. You're just going to be a dumb ego flying through space and, you know, keep your fingers crossed and hope that it works out. And so then going back to the invitation, you know, the invitation, I think, is something of a kind of a mental interrupt from like compulsive habitual behavior or just, you know, just kind of, you know, being whipped around. Like I was saying, if we can stop to think, like, especially when we're entering into things like, all right, well, you know, what's going on here? Who is this other person? What am I committing to? What am I jumping in? What's on the other side? Not that I know like what's going to happen, but, you know, is there a certain amount of support, you know, in this? Am I coming in? Like, I can give you an example, going back earlier to one of the questions of going into jobs. Like before I knew about any of this, you know, I would go into jobs. I used to work in software for software companies, and I would show up as like, I try to be the best looking manifesting generator I could for them, you know, like, and I was out there, you know, calling people, sending out resumes, doing stuff like that. And then I would find myself, you know, being hired as a manifesting generator to go work really hard. You know, it's something I supposedly love doing, you know, to when that really wasn't the case. I can look back and see those, you know, the times when I didn't wait for an invitation and when I kind of, you know, wasn't following my strategy at all. You know, I was just being, again, kind of carried along by whatever, you know, whatever energies and whatever was expected and the way I thought things are supposed to work.
I think we can all recognize ourselves in doing that at job interviews.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We're the best at everything at job interviews. I always said, I'm like, oh, my stress levels are so high. I could do like 20 projects at the same time. I used to work as a project manager and I actually worked about like 50 or 60 hours a week. And it was just crazy. And I'm like, I don't even, and now when I look back, I'm like, how did I even do that? And being a mom on top of that, I was just, it was crazy.
Yeah,
I'm happy I'm not living that life anymore. Like, I get exhausted just talking about it, but yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, if you bring in the open root or the undefined root, and that's another big one for me is the burnout is real. It's the adrenal dysfunction, everything that, you know, they say about the root I experienced and I would definitely try to go faster to do more and, you know, cross as many things off my list as I could, and it would just fill up again. And eventually, it's just kind of burnout and exhaustion. Mm. And so it was a big, you know, healing, I guess, process, and it all actually happened before human design came in, because it all kind of kicked off right around my Uranus opposition, and which is basically at 42. And then I think a couple of years later, human design showed up, and that was like the kind of the final piece. I had started making some changes. I had left two jobs, but still couldn't make sense of everything. Like, why is this all happening? And human design kind of brought some more clarity to that.
Mm. I'm not a projector, but you guys are. So I wanted to know, when you get an invitation, how does it feel different for you if you get recognized and get an invitation compared to just an invitation where you don't feel recognized?
The recognition piece feels like it's just for you. Like, it feels like being seen, you know, kind of like it sounds, you know, and it's specific. It kind of sets up a situation where I can enter in as myself and not have to pretend to be a generator, or, you know, there's a recognition of what I can bring to the table, or what my values, gifts, talents, whatever are. And it will often feel like, I can just show up and be myself and do what I would probably do anyway. And there's an exchange happening, and there's support or energy coming in. That to me kind of gets us in the ballpark of a good invitation with recognition, where you don't have to compromise yourself. You don't have to try to be something other than you are. And the other person sees you, and you can feel that almost. Mm-hmm. There's a certain kind of, I just want you to show up and do what you do. And I can look back, and I had a really good invitation at one point. It came in pre-human design, but I was able to look back on it. And I had been working for a software company, and I ended up leaving. I had left two software companies and then went on my own as like an independent contractor. And I had built a relationship with a company through my last job where I'd been. And they came to me at a certain point and they said, hey, what would it take just to have you on call, to have your time? Just what would it take if when we needed something, we were at the top of the list and you dropped what you're doing and helped us? And the rest of the time, we don't really care. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And we kind of worked out a number, and it was a good number. And that invitation lasted like 7 years, I think, 7 or 8 years. And what that did is it actually freed me up energetically to do what I wanted. It supported my definition. It supported my life and life force in a way that was actually correct and in alignment and healthy for me. And that was something that, you know, I don't think I couldn't have initiated. I couldn't have gone out there and just created that out of nothing or manifested it. It came to me through a relationship that I had built, and they saw my value, you know, in these situations, and they were willing to pay me for it. And basically it meant that I, you know, had almost a full salary for doing, you know, about a third of the work, you know, and that's, to me, that's a good projector job. You know, that's
hell yeah.
and then it ran out, like everything comes to an end, and then you're back to all right, well, waiting for other good invitations. The other one, I guess the other side of it, when things come in and there's not recognition, it almost feels like it's generic. It's like they're just throwing off, you know, request and seeing whose energy they can bring in, or they need something, but it's not really based on who I am really, or what, you know, my potential or my capacity for whatever it is. It's, it's kind of like we were talking about, you know, trying to, you know, come in as a really good manifesting generator for someone at a job. It's like, it's a mismatch. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's that wishful thinking component where you've been waiting for good invitations, and then something shows up, a request or an ask of some form. And then our minds jump in and say, oh, this must be it. And then we get into it and realize, no, this is not working out. And then this is kind of part of, I think, what it means to be a projector. It can be hard to remove ourselves from those situations. Once we get into something and kind of dive in, we tend to kind of, there's almost kind of a, I don't know what the right word is, like we get hooked into it, or we're kind of dependent on the energy, the resource, the money, or whatever. And extricating yourself from that is a process. So accepting bad invitations or being in situations and relationships that aren't really correct for us, I think, can come at a big cost for projectors. It can, you know, it goes pretty deep.
And I think this is maybe the biggest difference, because a lot of people ask, what's the difference for a generator and a projector? What's the difference between an invitation and a response? Mm-hmm. And I think you explained that very well now, that it has to do with, you have to feel seen for who you are as a projector. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that you just need to show up with what you have, mm-hmm. what you are.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I feel that way too, because I feel like waiting for the right invitation is personal for a projector. It's not like every projector will get the same invitations, because it's really me and what I'm good at and my skills and my energy that I'm putting in. So I really, I second what you said, John.
And I just want to do what lights me up, what's fun.
it's a lot simpler, good for you. Really, in a way, with the sacral authority. I was just thinking of this kind of, I'd never thought of it before, but this image of a casting call comes up in my mind right now. So, you know, like, you know, in film or whatever, you know, just, hey, we need a bunch of extras. We need a bunch of people out there, you know, and it's very generic. It's not specific. It's like, we're just going to post this thing. That's certainly not an invitation, you know, versus someone calling you up, you know, and saying, we have this role for you. And, you know, it's, we can't think of anyone else who we would want more. So what will it take to get you here? You know, versus just, I'm going to go respond to, you know, the flyer that I saw in the casting call. That, you know, it's kind of cartoonish, but it, I think it really highlights, there's a big difference between those two things. Mm.
And I guess you can feel being recognized also as a feeling, you know, you feel it when someone sees you, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely. It is. It's energetic. This is another aspect of, you know, the invitations are usually kind of thought of as formal And I think they are. And the big ones, the important ones, they're going to come in these ways that we're talking about. But there, I think there's another layer to it. If you kind of take it into daily life and like your regular interactions with people in the world, you can be sitting in a room and feel like there's a bunch of people at a table talking, and we're getting ready to go into the holidays here in the United States for Thanksgiving, and families get together and there's big groups of people. Well, I used to get in those situations with, you know, with my open throat and all the open centers, and I would just be kind of running around trying to keep up and you know, trying to fill the space in a way. And, you know, we'd be at dinner and there'd be a bunch of people talking, and I would start feeling the pressure to speak or to play along or to fill up that space as well. And I think that, you know, there was just a lot of conditioning going on in those situations. And so kind of seeing that dynamic and just kind of watching what happens, you know, when I hold back and I wait and, you know, wait for someone to actually turn to me, you know, and, you know, in my home family, it was usually my mom who would get uncomfortable with my silence, you know, after a while, like, John, you've just been sitting there for, you know, the whole time and you haven't said a word, you know, and I would be like, well, you haven't asked me a question or addressed me. And I'm not trying to be a pain in the butt about the whole thing, but that was part of the deconditioning process as well, is to basically just wait and watch. And the thing that I found is it saved so much energy. And I'd spent so much time early in my life of trying to have more energy. And I was doing a lot of things that projectors do, like you know, basically self-medicating in a while. I'm going to drink a lot of coffee, or, you know, I'm going to go, I took a lot of Chinese herbs and had like Chinese doctors and supplements and all that stuff. All that was an effort just to have more energy than I did. And what I started finding is that I actually have enough energy to live my life as a projector if I'm not trying to live my life as a generator, mm-hmm. you know, and that by, you know, honoring my definition and then kind of working with strategy and authority and my undefined centers, I was basically wasting less energy, you know, leaking out less energy. And then that was a way of getting more energy, was wasting less energy. And then I found out that I actually have enough to get through the week now. You know, it's still a little bit of a push and pull thing. And some, you know, sometimes I have more energy than others, or I get run down, but I was on a kind of a crash course for, you know, a major kind of health breakdown before all of that. So it's gotten a lot better.
Hmm. That's good. And I'm thinking also I want to say to our listeners, if you're not a projector, but if you have a projector in your life, like a child or a spouse or a partner, I struggled in the beginning with understanding how am I supposed to see my projector son? Because all I heard that it's so important that you see the projector needs to be recognized. And I was like, okay, but I mean, I'm not sure if I see everything in him. But then I realized that it's just, he needed my attention. He needed me to just, you know, look at him when he spoke and just being with him. And that's all. It's not that difficult, really. It's just, you know, I have to be there when I'm with him and just see him, not seeing everything in him, but just seeing him.
Yeah. And that actually says so much about today's society as well, that everyone's like so stressed. We don't even have time to like really sit down and see each other. Whether or not you're a projector or not doesn't really matter, but we're just all over the place most of the time. So this is like something that I think everyone should practice more, like being more in the moment, because that's the place where you can actually feel what's going on in yourself as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels good. I mean, it feels good to be seen, like we were saying before. And, you know, projectors that have this kind of fundamental orientation towards the other or this question of, you know, who are you, who is the other? And we're here to see others, to recognize others, but we also really like being seen and recognized ourselves, and there's a certain energy to it. Oh, and this is what I was going to say earlier. I don't know if I actually got to it, but there is a space where you can feel that opening up in those type of interactions. Like if I'm at a table competing with, you know, six different voices and a lot more energy, it's kind of overwhelming. And I can, if I kind of slow down and start paying attention, I can actually feel when whether someone has said it or not, when that recognition or being seen comes in. And there's almost, I know there's some debate about this in the human design world, but I feel it as kind of like an energetic opening mm-hmm. in that moment. And I'm like, okay, now I can step in and it feels natural. It feels easy. It doesn't feel like I'm forcing my way or I'm competing. I think that's a big part of what it means to be a projector, is just being sensitive, paying attention, watching, looking. And then going back to your son, Emily, I think you're right. It's just, you know, kind of, you know, paying attention, you know, to him and kind of like, I think there's a kind of a curiosity in it and kind of a type of interest, like, who are you actually, you know, like, you know, and I think as parents, cause I'm a parent, I've had to kind of look at my relationship with my kids and see like how easy it is to kind of, for us to project our own stuff onto it. Like, well, this is what happened with my parents, so I'm going to do it this way with you. Some of that's kind of just the way it works. But the way I've kind of been, you know, looking at it with my kids more and more is like, you know, who are these people really? Like, who are these two human beings that I played a role in bringing them into the world? Yep. And getting to know them. Who are you? What's going on? What are you interested in? And they're manifesting generators. And to me, that just feels like that's my type of parenting, is to see my kids, to appreciate them, to look at them. And kind of, you know, Marley, like you were saying, I think that goes kind of for all of us on a certain level. We can all probably appreciate that in the same way that I think, you know, everyone probably appreciates being informed at times, even though that's the manifestor strategy. It's like, you know, hey, this might affect you, so I'm gonna, you know, get out in front of it, or, you know, inform you, we can talk about it. So yeah.
Yeah. We're all human behind the auras.
Right. It's true.
We are.
So do you feel like you have anything else that you want to bring up before we finishing this podcast?
Well, we had talked earlier a little bit about just the being a male projector thing and some of the implications of that. And I think, you know, I could say a few words about that. And, you know, there's a type of receptivity, I think, in the projector aura, you know, where, you know, there is a, I would say both kind of a yin and a yang quality. And, you know, the penetrating aspect of the projector aura and the focus, but it's deeply absorbing, deeply receptive. And, you know, and I think the invitation is kind of a type of protection, I think, you know, in terms of helping us get clear or to see or to be in alignment with whatever we're kind of getting into or signing on to. And so that's kind of interesting from the point of view of, you know, being a male, is that, you know, if I'm expected to go out there and initiate conversations, interactions, relationships, you know, because of certain gender stereotypes or whatever, it's never worked for me. It's just, this was another way that it was kind of confirming to figure out what it meant to be a projector, is I look back and I'm like, I've never really been that successful doing that. It's never really worked that way. So it's interesting to kind of, to get out of the whole, some of these gender constructs, you know, and just like look at it in terms of mechanics and energy and people, and realize like you have, you know, women manifestors, you know, it's like there's a pretty big, you know, role reversal there. And so that's what's so kind of refreshing about human design for me, is it just kind of cuts through so much stuff, and you can just, you know, see things more for what they are and honor them for what they are. But yeah, the male projector thing is interesting, and I was kind of already doing it, I guess, on a certain level, but then at the same time, like we've been talking about, I was also running around like a mad person and, you know, initiating all sorts of stuff and, you know, that didn't really work out. So, it's a mixed bag as far as that went.
Have you had any experiences, Marlee, with male projectors not wanting to recognize their own energy?
Not really. Actually, I don't work with that many men yet.
Not yet.
No, not that I can think about. But I just, as I said like earlier, I just think the general gender parts in society is that everyone is in like the really masculine energy, like micromanaging everything, and we need to be proactive and we need to do things a certain way. So I guess when a man hears that he's a projector, he feels kind of passive. It doesn't have to be that way, but I think that's like the first kind of interaction with that energy type. But I guess, I mean, I've worked with a lot of women as well, women projectors, and they don't really like the notion of waiting for the invitation either, because we're all like so programmed to be out there just grabbing things. We're like, what does it mean to wait? It sounds so passive. But I think that's something that all of us need to do. We need to take a step back and kind of just reconnect with ourselves, because otherwise we won't know. I mean, even outside of human design, because here in Sweden or Scandinavia, there isn't that many people that even know about human design. But this is like something that people can use in their everyday life, just taking a step back and really like assessing the situation.
Yeah. And all of the types have this element of waiting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even manifestors, they're waiting for their will to move. They're waiting for clarity, you know, whatever it is. And I don't, you know, I don't think the waiting is as passive as it maybe people think at first, or as it sounds at first, because the way I'm seeing this strategy, the invitation, is it mostly has to do with your interactions in the outside world. You know, it's kind of relational. If we're not waiting, a projector doesn't need an invitation to study something. Projector doesn't need an invitation to eat or to take care of themselves or
That would be a real problem.
Right. It's like, you know, that's going to break down really quick, you know. Yeah. But you know, what are we doing while we're waiting? Well, we're watching, we're looking, we're seeing, we're studying, we're doing whatever we do.
Yeah.
But when it counts, you know, I think that's where this is a pretty helpful thing that human design is offering up with the strategy is like,
definitely,
you know, it's tends to be for the bigger things and the bigger relational things for projectors. You know, if you're a sacral generator, like you are, Emily, it's like, you can be in touch with that, you know, through, I would expect through your, you know, through your week, you know. It's like, yeah, I don't feel like doing this right now. I don't have the energy for it, or I do have the energy for it. So it's kind of a different dynamic for projectors, but it's still not that passive. It's like, well, do what you want until you know, that thing comes in, and then how's it coming in? And what's really going on there? What's your relationship with it?
Yeah. I just think that a lot of people are searching for something, but they still like want someone to just hand them the answer. They don't really want to do the experiment. And that's the thing that I meet like the most, that people are like, just tell me how I'm going to do this. And that's up to everyone to figure out. It's your own experiment.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, John. This was really fun.
Yeah,
it's
thank
been a pleasure.
You.
Great.
Yeah, thank you both.
Okay, thanks. So I will see you soon again. And
yes.
If any one of you who are listening would like to book a reading with you, they can do that, and we can give them the link under the description of the podcast to your page. And you also have a podcast yourself?
Yes, I do. I have a podcast with my partner, Amy Lee, called the Human Design Collective Podcast. And we put out episodes every so often. We try to do it once a month if we can, but we are two projectors, so it happens when it happens. And yeah, you can just search for the Human Design Collective Podcast.
Great. And you also do educations, right? Courses?
We do. We teach the foundation courses together. So we do Living Your Design, RAID ABCs, and RAVE Cartography. And those are ongoing. So we're usually running one or two courses at any given time. So, and you can find that at courses.humandesigncollective.com.
Perfect.
Great. Yay. Okay. I can very much recommend John anyway. I've tried him out many times.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. It was really nice to meet and be here today.
Yeah. Nice to meet you.
Bye.
All right.
Bye. Bye.